This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. Thousands upon thousands of European women accused of practicing witchcraft were tortured, burned alive, or hanged in the 1500s and 1600s. Was this based on people's fear of magic, on various kinds of medieval superstitions, or does this have something very significant to do with the so-called transition from feudalism to capitalism? Did the witch hunters tear women asunder for political reasons, for reasons that had to do with people's movements, with class antagonisms, with certain ideas about women's proper role in society? What does capitalist logic have to do with the massive witch hunts? Sylvia Federici has thoughtfully addressed these big-picture questions and many more in a book entitled Caliban and the Witch, Women, the Body, and Primitive Accumulation. Sylvia Federici is a veteran activist in the feminist and anti-death penalty movements, among others, and is a professor emerita at Hofstra University, where she taught political philosophy and international studies. She joins me now in our Berkeley studios. Welcome to you.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Caliban and the Witch. Where does the main title come from?
The main title comes from my confronting the question of the rise of capitalism, and in particular, the question of the resistance to capitalism. You know, my first interest was with all those populations that capitalism had to destroy, discipline, regiment, and the different forms of resistance that this repression evoked. And two figures stood out. One was the witch, which in a way was the rebel woman, was the old world universe of practices that empowers the women had, powers they had won in the struggle against feudalism and that they represented in the eyes of the new masters and which had to be exorcised. And the other figure was, of course, the colonial subject, was the Native American, was the African that equally, and, you know, the partner of the witch. At the same time in the book, I also use the notion of the Caliban to represent a broader areas of subject that also had to be subjugated. And I use the concept of the Caliban as a sort of a metaphor for the body. So the Caliban has a dual identity in the book. It represents the colonial subject, but also represents the proletarian body that had to be mechanized, had to be disciplined, had to be controlled, had to be broken up so that all its powers could be turned into labor power.
Caliban is a character in Shakespeare's play The Tempest, and he's sort of a wild, uncouth man.
Right. Right, yeah, yeah. Yes. Caliban, in fact, yes, come from the Tempest. He, you know, and he's the son of a witch, right? He is the son of an Algerian witch who is not present in the play. And he's, of course, subjugated by the arrival of Prospero, who is, in my view, definitely is a prefiguration of the colonial master,
mm-hmm.
who hates Caliban, calls him a monster, but at the same time continuously reaffirm that he and his daughter depend on his labor. So there is a double relationship of hatred and dependence. And in that way, it became the perfect metaphor, the perfect image for what I wanted to represent in the book.
Well, let's turn from metaphor to hard reality. Tell us some basics about the witch hunts of the 16th and 17th centuries. In which countries did they occur, and how many women were tried, tortured, or killed?
Well, first of all, I want to stress that for a long time, the witch hunt was conceived as a feudal phenomenon. as a response to, you know, as an expression of feudal superstition. And but this has now been conclusively proven faulty. And in fact, most of the persecution took place between the mid of the 16th century and the mid of the 17th century. In fact, the peak really is the period between 1560 and 1630. This is the period in which you have massive witch hunts in Europe. Thousands and thousands of women are actually, you know, brought to court, tortured, and in most cases, executed. So it is definitely not a feudal phenomenon and is associated with a whole range of transformation that were taking place from England to France, Scotland, Germany, Italy, Switzerland. These are really the center of the witch hunts in Europe in this period. And they are associated with the broad range of transformation that we now associate with the rise of capitalism. Primarily, for example, land expropriation. I see the witch hunt as being very, very important, a central moment of the assault on the commons, on communalism in all its form, not only the commons as common, you know, property, as the communal land that the European rural proletarian, you know, held, but also all the communal practices that were associated to the land ownership. And of course, it was an attack on practices that were particularly identified with women. For example, magical practices above all, healing, predicting the future, divining what may happen, finding lost objects. Women were attributed a broad range of power, which we call magical powers, that represented a strength for the community. It represented a sort of, a bulwark that, intensified their resistance, to the new system, to the new relations of capitalism that were coming in this period, particularly in the rural area.
Let me delve into some portions of that very rich answer, and let's start with dispossession and closure. So you said there was a lot of communal property, it was held in common, people enjoyed the use of this commonly held property, and then enclosure, privatization, the literal fencing off of this property took place. What happened in terms of peasants and peasant resistance to such dispossession that was part of the context we need to understand for the eventual witch hunts?
Right. Yes. The witch hunt certainly occurs in a period in which you have a massive rebellion against the process of enclosure. And you can see that very clearly, for example, in England, where in the mid-16th century, you have a rebellion like the Cat Rebellion, where thousands of people, came together and to pull up the fences that were built around the commons, and they actually raised peasant armies. You have a peasant wars taking place in Germany from the late part of the 15th century through the earliest of the 16th. And again, you have, in the case of Germany, several armies of peasants who battled with the armies of the nobility. And, this tremendous and evoked an enormous repression. We are told that at least 100,000 people were exterminated because of the over a period of two decades, because of the peasant war in Germany. Now, these are the areas, these are the region in which you also have important witch hunts. But aside from this situation, which is in a sense a climax of resistance, a process of enclosure was taking place between the 1500 and the late part of the 17th century, practically throughout Western Europe. And I think when you look at some of the main crimes that were imputed to witches and who the witches were, you see very well the connection between the enclosure of communal land, land expropriation, and the charge of witchcraft. You know, for example, the most of the women were very poor women. You know, the women, you know, they lived begging, going from door to beg for a little bit of food. Clearly relying on a certain communal conception of existence, clearly expected that there will be a community that might support them in their poverty. And also these were women who were accused, not only, they were accused of being, resisting, you know, their pauperization. They were seen as envious in the charges raised against them. They were seen as envious, as, you know, doing evil, because of the envy they had towards the possession of their neighbors, accused of bewitching their animals, of going out in the dark at night, feeding on these animals, raising storms to destroy the crops. So the question of envy, of evil, an alliance with the devil stimulated by the envy for the possession, and also the charge of theft. In Germany, many witches were called milk thieves. So the charge that they steal from their neighbor with magical practices, it's also very common. So you have a landscape when you put together. You know, the social identity of these women, where I said in most cases were poor, dispossessed, and the crimes of which they are accused. You begin to see that this is a landscape of a population that has been expropriated.
To the extent that these women were accused or thought of as resisting pauperization, what can you tell us about the role that women played, specifically women played, in these massive peasant revolts against feudal and emerging capitalist elites?
Yes, women had a very important role, and I think it's a role that we still even have to appreciate and learn about further. But one immediate role is the struggle against enclosure. For example, in England, above all, in the 17th century, women were often in the forefront of the struggle against they were the ones who went out with the pikes and with children, and they, took off the fences, and there are some very famous names associated with it, legends associated with the struggle. And it's very clear the women were particularly interested because they were the one who suffered most, to pay the highest price for the loss of the communal land. The men could take the road, try the highway, once they were expropriated. Women were those who remained. Women were those, in a sense, who were holding up the fabric of social life. And this has been true in every community across the world. And so they are the ones also most resistant to the dissolution of communal bond. And this was manifested in so many ways, not only, again, in the struggle in the fields, but also in the struggle against the decollectivization of social life. The exclusion from the wedding, the exclusion from a whole set of relations that are more and more now being reshaped under the influence of the market, under the influence of commercialization, and the individualization of social life, where the family, rather than the community, the collectivity, becomes the focus. And so this type of resistance, it's not unique to England, but you also see it in other countries. And associated with it is also the power the women had that were attributed to them by the community. You know, I mentioned before the power of healing, the power of divination. Now, these begin to pose a threat. In fact, in England in particular, a ban was placed against the prophecies that were seen as almost a call for subversion, because you could read the future in a way has to instigate rebellion. And again, in that sense, this power, whether the ruling class, the new ruling class, believed in that or not, certainly was seen as a threat, you know, particularly in a context in which you have a centralization of the state and you have an attempt to really establish a more capillary control on everyday life, you know, of the rural and urban proletariat.
Her name is Silvia Federici. She is a scholar, a veteran activist, a professor emerita at Hofstra University. She's editor of the volume Enduring Western Civilization, The Construction of the Concept of Western Civilization and Its, quote, Others. She is co-editor with George Kafensis of A Thousand Flowers, Social Struggles Against Structural Adjustment in African Universities. She's been active in the feminist movement, the movement against the death penalty, and the anti-corporate globalization movement. And we're talking about a book she wrote, published several years ago, but still of, I think, enduring importance. It's entitled Caliban and the Witch, Women, the Body, and Primitive Accumulation, published by Autonomedia. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. The associate producer is H.N. Yuen. Noel Hanrahan is at the controls. My name is C.S. Song. Primitive accumulation, this term is in the title of your book. The concept is essential to your analysis. Let's just assume we have listeners out there who haven't gone to graduate school, have never heard the term before. Can you give us a basic definition of primitive accumulation? And maybe we could start with what Karl Marx meant by the term.
Right. Marx coined the term primitive accumulation, and there's a famous chapter on it at the end of Volume 1 of Capital. And he coined this term actually to explain how capitalism takes off. And you basically reason that, you know, in order for capital to take off, there has to be an accumulation of wealth prior to the actual beginning of the capitalist mode of production. So, and he identified the period in which this prior accumulation occurs, you know, with the mid-16th century, and he identified in particular England as the central place, as the first place in which capitalist relation, you know, expand. Although at the same time, there was another primitive accumulation that was also taking place, which I think deserves as much attention, which is the accumulation in the America, which in fact is contemporary to the process in England. And so by primitive accumulation, Marx referred to, you know, the broad, you know, set of the broad assault on the condition of the rural peasantry, you know, by which, you know, the rural peasantry was dispossessed, divorced, separated, you know, from the communal lands which they had in common and which they managed in common, and which had been a source of sustenance and also, you know, a source of collective relation. And the basis for the kind of, you know, what Tony called the village democracy and village communism. And, you know, the fact that the land was held in common meant, you know, a whole... it meant a world that we still are trying to recapture, but find often even difficult to conceptualize. The degrees of interconnectedness, you know, the ties that bound people, created a very strong communal life that resisted, that became a tremendous source of resistance first against feudal power. By the end of the 14th century, in fact, feudal power was in crisis. And in fact, in the book, I connect the rise of capitalism, you know, to this crisis of feudalism, provoked mostly by the struggle of the peasantry. However, in the what I try to do in the book is also to present another side of primitive accumulation. Because Marx sees primitive accumulation and the rise of capitalism as depending again on the separation of workers from the land, and I insist that, you know, there are another dimension that needs to be, you know, reconsidered.
And this has to do with women's bodies.
Which has to do with the women's body, the enclosing of women's body, the appropriation by the state of women's reproductive power, which in fact is very much part of the witch hunt. If crimes against property are one dimension, another dimension of the witch hunt, it's crime against what I call reproductive crimes, crimes related to procreation, sexuality. So the witch is not only the beggar woman who goes from house to house, and when she's refused, she curses, she threatens, but she is also, you know, the woman who is accused of infanticide, and the woman who is accused of prostitution, of lewd sexual practices. And I see this enclosure, this attack on female sexuality and on reproductive, so-called reproductive crime, as really an essential part of primitive accumulation, where women, in a sense, have to be expropriated of their body, where in a context in which labor becomes, you know, is beginning to be identified as a new form of wealth, and the worker becomes acquires a new economic value. So the procreation, too, now, it becomes extremely important, and I would say as a means of accumulating workers. And
mm-hmm. What kinds of demographic changes were happening in Europe at this time, such that elites were especially, say, concerned about making sure that the workforce could be reproduced through women's reproduction?
Right. You had, in fact, there is a crescendo, because it's very interesting that the first witch hunt happened after the Black Death at the sunset of the Middle Ages, you know, the famous plague that destroyed presumably at least one third of the European population. But you also have a demographic crisis. You have a demographic crisis at the end of the 16th century, and clearly connected to the type of pauperization that was taking place in Europe, you know, in a context in which, with the extension of market relation, you have, for example, the prices of grain, the prices of foodstuff, and in a context which people were already beginning to lose land on which to rely upon for their sustenance, you have a tremendous increase, in fact, the first price inflation in Europe. The first price inflation all the prices of edible things escalated, and you have immense impoverishment. In fact, there is an uncanny comparison between the period that saw the rise of capitalism in 16th, 17th century and the follow-up of globalization, where you have, in conjunction with massive privatization of land, privatization of natural resources, you also have a tremendous rise in a food crisis, rise in the price of foodstuff, and pauperization on a massive scale. Right? This is, again, is the context in which the witch hunt takes place. And this provokes a crisis, a demographic crisis. For example, especially acute in certain areas like Germany, you know, where there's the visible decline of the size of the population. And to me, certainly this was an important motivating context to explain why, you know, the attack on abortion, infanticide, you know, become more and more prominent in the accusation against the witches.
Why wouldn't the state or the church, and you make the very important argument in this book that the state and the church took part in a very organized political attempt that constituted the witch hunts. This was not a spontaneous thing from the below, and then the elites heard about this, and then they wanted to respond. But if that were the case, why wouldn't the state and the church simply round up these women and say, you know, you must procreate, and we're going to reform you such that you will become people who bring forth a new working class, as opposed to simply, you know, burning them alive, hanging them, I mean, essentially exterminating a whole group of women?
Well, it's not, See, I make a comparison between the witch hunt often and the war on terror, and the charge of witchcraft and the charge of terrorism. And the comparison is that both of them are so broad, you know, so undefined, that so they can be adjusted to persecute any type of crime. And I see these charges, this type of charge, which have this characteristic, as typical of those moments, you know, of great social change, where in a sense, as I write in the book, is now one particular crime or a particular identified set of crimes that are the object of the persecution. But it's basically, these are moments of mass education and mass transformation. These are moments in which, you know, broad range of practices have to be destroyed. And, you know, the attack on you know, women's reproductive power, the attack on women as infanticide, which is what the witches were accused of, or the midwives, and, you know, are really an attempt to institute reforms that go very deep into the community, into the psyche. It is not so easy to run people, and you had to have slavery. That type of situation took place, you know, in the Americas, took place in the Caribbean islands, but under slavery, when you can actually have such a level of control mm-hmm. on the body of the woman that you can actually impose on her, you can rape and you can impose on her a maternity she doesn't want. This was not accomplishable uh-huh. in the context of the village, where to some extent, you know, a community of women still existed, you know, more and more under siege. You know, women were forced to accuse each other. And in fact, this was one of the devices, the strategies that were most powerful, you know, in isolating women, in breaking down the kind of solidarity that had been characteristic of the Middle Age, due to the fact also that women share collective forms of reproduction, that the organization of work was always a collective organization of work, and there was a tremendous power. Now, in order to transform that, in order to internalize that fear, and you know, you're having a charge that, in a sense, is more powerful, and of course, that charge was, you know, accompanied by excruciating, you know, ordeals, excruciating tortures, but you could not have achieved the same goal except through this generalized terror, which is what takes place through the witch hunt.
I'm CS. She is Sylvia Federici, Federici. Co-founded the International Feminist Collective, she did, in 1972. Since then, she's been active in the International Campaign for Wages for Housework, with the New York Wages for Housework Committee, and with the Radical Philosophy Association's Anti-Death Penalty Project. We're talking about a book she wrote entitled Caliban and the Witch, Women, the Body, and Primitive Accumulation. We're going to take a short break, and then I want to ask Sylvia about the sexual division of labor. I want to ask her more about the magical practices and how they threatened elites such that these witch hunts were initiated and took place. I want to ask her about science, the relationship of the witch hunts to the rise of modern science, and to parallels of these witch hunts to what happened in the New World and what's happening today. Please stay with us. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. The associate producer is H.N. Ewan. My name is C.S. Song. Joining us in our Berkeley studios is Sylvia Federici, a veteran scholar, longtime activist, professor emerita at Hofstra University, author of, among other books, Caliban and the Witch, Woman, the Body, and Primitive Accumulation, which makes many arguments, including the fact that the persecution of witches in the 16th and 17th centuries in Europe was a central aspect of the accumulation and formation of the modern proletariat, of the modern working class in Europe as well as in the New World. It had much to do, not so much with the medieval superstition, but with controlling and disciplining human labor. And in relation to labor and the logic of labor under capitalism, Sylvia, we all know that wages are paid to, quote, workers, but not to women for their so-called domestic work. What argument are you making here about the origins of this division of labor into waged labor, often male labor, originally, and unpaid labor?
Yes, I see very much, you know, the witch hunt as being part of, you know, that period, that important period of transition in which a new social division of labor is created with the rise of capitalism, and a social division that separates, you know, divides, differentiates the labor of women and the labor of men to a far greater degree than it had been the case, you know, pre-capitalist Europe, in pre-capitalist societies, in the sense that with the rise of capitalism, you know, the kind of unity between production and reproduction that had prevailed, you know, in an economy based on communal management of land and the communal relation, you know, begins to separate. And, you know, only commodity production, it begins to be seen as economic, as pertaining to the economy, and as having an economic value. And in fact, as being work, it's the only kind of work recognized, whereas all reproductive activities begin to disappear as economic activities. They are not seen as part of the economy any longer. They begin to take on a quality of being, you know, natural activity pertaining to nature. And in fact, you have a double process taking place. On one side, the devaluation of this activity, the economization of this activity, if you wish, and also the feminization, because now the separation between women and men becomes along the line of production versus reproduction. By and large, you know, women become the subject of reproduction and men the subject of commodity production. And this has been the case, in fact, through the history of capitalism until, you know, only broken down by the resistance that women have opposed to that. And so we have a labor that is unwaged, which is becoming more and more invisible, devalued, that has not recognized social position. And I see that this kind of devaluation, which is a devaluation of women's work, is a devaluation of women's social position, has also been part of what the witch hunt brings about. The witch hunt, in a sense, is a war on women's power. It's a process that devalues the woman, that degrades women, and in that sense becomes an important support, you know, to this new reorganization of the division of labor.
And this division of labor and this separation of men from women, did it have anything to do with creating divisions among people, between people? Because, of course, we have the elites and the people, and yet capitalist logic, as you write about, has something to do with fomenting.
Absolutely, absolutely, yes. The witch hunt divides women from men. The witch hunt, you know, makes men fear women. I have written that the witch hunt taught men to see the power the women had developed against the power structure as power against them. So, one of the charges against witches is that they make men impotent. You know, this is a very constant accusation, castration. Right, so that men have to fear women, and there is another dimension also, of course, to this question, that with the rise of capitalism and the transformation in the organization of work and the intensification of work discipline, that is premised on also on a discipline of sexuality, female and male. And in this context, you know, women's sexuality is seen as a threat, is seen as a threat to the kind of role that men are expected to perform in the new society, which is to be the beneficiary of women reproductive services. So the witch hunt, in fact, reshapes the relationship between women and men in a very divisive way, in a very antagonistic way, both differentiating the work that women and men do and creating a psychological distances between them and fostering basically men a fear of women. At the very moment in which a new shape, the male figure, the man beginning because of the power of the wage, because of the different position they have, they are assigned in the new organization of work, and they also are assigned, you know, they are basically entitled to the work of women. In fact, I see that through the reorganization of work that takes place in this period, women are presented, you know, they are transformed in a way, in a sort of a common, become a new common land that, you know, men are told and that they can be exploited freely in the same way as a natural resource.
Tell us about, to get to maybe some of the concrete practices of people who identified as witches or people accused of witches back in those times, tell us about the gathering of witches called the Sabbat and about what most disturbed authorities about it.
Very interesting, because in fact the Sabbat is a kind of representation, you know, of all the fears of the new master class with regard to the proletariat, and particularly with regard to women. Right, the Sabbat is a demonic gathering. It's a gathering called by the devil to which people, witches from great distances, you know, travel to, there they perform all kinds of abominations. They fed on all kinds of foods that would at that time were certainly off limits for the proletariat. They also copulated across classes. They copulated men, you know, with men, women with women. They copulated with animals. So all the theme are central to the witch hunt are actually represented in the Sabbat. You know, illicit power. Illicit practices, right? And they're all enacted there, and of course the subservience to the devil and homage proffered to the devil, right? So what stands out, there have been many analyses of the Sabbat, but what stands out is sort of the collective character, which is particularly prominent in the earliest representation in the earliest trials. The collective character of witchcraft, you know, the witches as a sect, the witches as an organization, so they suggest the fear of women's organization, of collectivities, you know, towards the later part of the witch hunt. By the late 17th century, witchcraft begins to be represented as a more individual practice, less and less as a collective practice, you know, a sign that in a way the community itself is changing, social relations have changed. Mm. But in the first part, this collective character of which is very strong, and the Sabbath is certainly a representation of that. There are also other elements of it that are very interesting. The flight, right? The nocturnal flight, the night as the time, you know, activities in the night are always transgressive activity. There are activities that break a certain discipline of work. And similarly, the nomadism, right? The ability of the worker to escape because expropriation, expulsion from the land, you know, was not expected to result into the the expelled workers, you know, fleeing from the community. On the contrary, they were expected to remain and to accept, you know, a wage work and, of course, a scarcity as their destiny. So the flight is also penalized. And, of course, the relationship with the animals, because the Sabbath is the site of this copulation with animal. The witches are brought to the Sabbath, traveling on horses, on goats. And, you know, this is the period also in which the witch hunt is instrumental to establish a new relationship with people and animals. You know, the attack on everything that is instinctual, sexual, you know, translate also in an attempt to separate animals and humans.
I think a lot of people would find your interpretation of what happened very compelling. But I'm inclined to ask, what do we know about what people said and wrote about these practices, what especially authorities said and wrote about these practices that supports, that buttresses what you are telling us? In other words, is this your sense of what was behind the persecution of witches, or was there an actual explicit indication from the people doing the persecution that this is why we're doing it?
You have to, in a sense, reinterpret, and you know, some of the statement. But I think that the characterization that I'm giving, it's supported by the text, even though you cannot rely on a literary reading of this text. But for example, the characterization of the witch as a person who is motivated by envy, motivated by resentment, who makes a pact to the devil to have power that should not be available to her. Like, for example, there is a very, very interesting question here, and the relationship between women and money is demonized in the ideology of the witch hunt. Like, women are approached by the devil when they are in need. So there's a recognition, in fact, that the women who are becoming witches are poor women, pauperized, and the devil offers them money. The devil comes and says, you will not have to suffer any longer, and gives them money. And so this description, a very graphic description of a community of expropriated women who are seen by the authority as aspiring to a power that they should not have. You know, you also have some very explicit description of who the witches are. For example, in a case that I mentioned of the Basque witches in the early 17th century, who are persecuted and killed by this French inquisitor, who sees them. These are women of a Basque village who were very independent because their husband were part of the cod fleet, who every year would spend, you know, many weeks, you know, going to fish the cod. And so these women practically became the soul of the community. They had a tremendous amount of communal solidarity and independence. And Langer was appalled by it. He saw them, in fact, he said, this is a whole population of witches. These mm-hmm. women are mm-hmm. all witches. And there's also, of course, the question that I raise in the book about the impact, the interconnectedness between the witch hunt in Europe and the witch hunt in America. You know, how starting from a certain point, you know, which the ideology and the practice of witch hunting is brought by the conquistadores, is brought to America. And in fact, is used to subjugate the American population. And I examine in particular a case of Mexico and even more so Peru. But at a certain point also, there is a return effect, a boomerang effect, in the sense that the kind of practices of mass extermination that were applied in the so-called New World are also brought back into Europe and applied to the witch hunt in Europe, which, according to some historian, is also one of the reasons for the massive escalation at the turn of the 17th century of the persecution.
As you write, Karl Marx believed that the violence that accompanied the earliest phases of capitalism's development would recede over time, that violence would be replaced by certain logics and disciplinary forces that didn't involve violence. Has that prediction been correct according to your analysis?
Absolutely not. No, Marx, this is one of the greatest political mistakes that Marx made. In fact, if we look at just even the last two centuries of capitalism, we see the violence not only has not diminished, but actually violence on a world scale has been a constant, to this day, has been a constant component of capitalist development, capitalist accumulation. I mean, the two world wars, colonialism. So in that sense, and Marx was wrong. And in fact, you can say that, you know, a claim is often made now that primitive accumulation, not only primitive accumulation in our time, has become a permanent process. You know, we are witnessing now of globalization can definitely be read as a process of primitive accumulation on a world scale. But, you know, primitive accumulation is going on almost on a daily basis. We are now witnessing a capitalism that continuously separates people from the means of their subsistence, whether be, you know, jobs, whether be land, whether be housing. So that prediction certainly has failed.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. On againstthegrain.org, you'll find a link to Silvia Federici's book, Caliban and the Witch, Women, the Body, and Primitive Accumulation. Silvia is a professor emerita at Hofstra University, where she taught political philosophy and international studies from 1987 to 2005. And she is a longtime activist and has written widely on culture, education, feminist theory, and feminist movements, and the impact of globalization. Just a few minutes left. If we turn to places like Africa, India, Papua New Guinea, how does witch hunting, or to what extent has witch hunting taken place in those areas?
Very, very important. I'm very glad you're asking me this question, because I would have imagined, as I was working on this book, that I would actually hear of witch hunt taking place in my own lifetime. And this is what, in fact, has been occurring since at least the late 1980s, especially in Africa, but now extending all over the world in India, as you said, Papua, there are cases also in Latin America, where predominantly, again, women and predominantly all women, although in the case of Africa now we have also children accused of being witches, and we have also some old men accused of being witches, are rounded up and are killed, and there's a mounting evidence that this persecution has once again to do with the attack on communal land, with the kind of scramble for African land and African minerals that are taking place now across the continent. And as ancestral land are being given away to companies, the fomenting of witch hunt, the fomenting of charges of bewitchment becomes a very useful instrument for separating a population under siege, as it was certainly in the earliest phase of capitalism, or the rise of capitalism in Europe. And in the north of Ghana, for example, there is now a witches' camps where you have about 1,000 women who have been expelled from their villages to under the charge of being witches. But there have been witch hunts in the Congo, in Zambia. In Zambia, for example, in the 90s, through the 90s, you had witch finders going from village to village, hired by, you know, individuals in the community, and brought to the village and forced the population would be forced to line up in front of them, and they would decide who was to be punished and who was not. And punishment would involve dispossession, taken over. Women, market women, have been among the targets who are seen as competing, because there's certainly an element of the witch hunt that has to do also with the fear of women in a time in which the whole community is losing power, and therefore an attempt by some men also to capitalize on the persecution by turning into witch hunters and by suppressing the threat of competing women's economic activity, you know, by the charge of witchcraft.
And is this
so this is now happening, as I said, across Africa, but also in India. You were asking me a question.
And is this where the vagueness, the very broad nature of the accusation of witchcraft really helps the authorities?
Absolutely. So, you know, in fact, more and more, the sign of the political nature of this accusation, you know, is in fact that it's not longer the specific crimes that are the object of the punishment, but the accused that you are a witch. Right? So that in fact the charge of witchcraft is disconnected even from any specific crime. You know, just being a witch, just being an evil person. And it's a charge that is terrifying and extremely powerful in a negative way, because it excludes. It says you are the enemy of humanity. It says anything can be done to you.
We have to leave it right there. Sylvia Federici, Federici. Again, a link to her book, Caliban and the Witch, Women, the Body, and Primitive Accumulation, published by Autonomedia on our site, againstthegrain.org, editor of the volume Enduring Western Civilization, co-editor with George Kafensis of A Thousand Flowers, Social Struggles Against Structural Adjustment in African Universities. Sylvia, thank you so much for joining us
today. Oh, thanks
to
you for inviting me. Thank you very much.
And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we will look for you next time. Against the Grain is produced by C.S. Song with associate producer H.N. Yuen. You can visit againstthegrain.org to find ways to reach us. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670. And thanks to Noel Hanrahan, who is at the controls.